This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, the 5th of May, 2008. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear about the devastation and emergency relief effort in cyclone-hit Myanmar. We'll go to Bolivia, where a referendum vote has highlighted the nation's racial, class, and economic differences. And we'll check in on the Democratic campaign trail just one day before two very important primaries. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Protests continued today in central Somalia, where U.S. missiles landed last week, and demonstrations over food shortages turned violent in Mogadishu. Emmanuel Okella reports from neighboring Uganda.
The Thursday U.S. air raid targeted Aden Hashi Airo, a senior commander of the militant group Al-Shabaab. Airo was killed along with four others in the house. Five other casualties were civilians from surrounding homes. Over 1,000 residents of Dusamareb participated in weekend protests, with many of them shouting anti-American slogans. One of the demonstrators said they were worried about further attacks because U.S. military planes continued flying over their city. Al-Shabaab, with the U.S. links to Al-Qaeda, controls central and southern Somalia. The group says it is simply a Somali movement and rejects any involvement with Al-Qaeda. The Dusamareb protest came as similar riots broke out in the capital Mogadishu today over food shortages. Troops opened fire and killed at least two people as tens of thousands of people rioted over high food prices. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okella.
Factory owners in Bangladesh have started distributing subsidized food to thousands of their lowest-paid workers. Rising food costs forced many Bangladeshis to reduce the amount they eat each day. Yesterday, the Bush administration announced an additional $40 million worth of food aid for Bangladesh. This as President George W. Bush draws sharp criticism for comments he made Friday suggesting the expanding middle class in India is partly to blame for the world's food crisis. Bush said that wealth leads people to start demanding better nutrition and better food, and that causes the prices to go up. A primary school and a busy marketplace are bombed in Darfur today. At least 13 are dead. The UN's Africa Union Mission in Darfur, or UNAMID, expressed concern at the rising toll of civilian deaths. FSRN's Joshua Chilimpa reports.
Aid organizations are reporting that of the 13 people killed as a result of Khartoum's bombing raids, seven were children, who died after a primary school and a busy market were hit. According to aid groups, a government Antonov plane bombed the village of Shegeg Karo in North Darfur on Sunday in what could be the deadliest bombing raid in Darfur in years. The Shegeg Karo school was hit while in session and one classroom was destroyed. Two other children were seriously wounded and 30 more lightly wounded. The primary school has a population of 238 students. The bombs are also reported to have hit a market, killing six people and destroying 20 shops. It is not clear how many people were wounded at the marketplace. Hundreds of women usually gather there on market day. UNAMID has called the bombing raids an unacceptable act against civilians, compounding the extent of displacement, insecurity, and untold human suffering. They said they were mobilizing their helicopters to evacuate the injured. The Sudanese army is yet to comment about the bombing incident, but has repeatedly denied bombings in the area, which would be a violation of the UN Security Council resolution banning all offensive flying. Last week, a joint UN-Africa Union peacekeeping mission confirmed rebel reports of bombing in North Darfur in spite of government denials. Joshua Chalimpa, FSRN, Kampala, Uganda.
5 years after the invasion of Iraq, Jordan hosts a major Iraq reconstruction exhibition. Ula Ferwadi is in Amman and has details.
Several hundred companies from 30 countries convened in Amman for the 5th Iraq Reconstruction Expo, which also hosts a number of Iraqi officials. These companies, which specialize in everything from water sanitation to manufacturing basic commodities, hope to benefit from attractive contracts. The rebuilding of Iraq is considered the world's largest reconstruction process. The exhibition, which runs through Thursday, will showcase means to expedite the reconstruction. An audit by the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction has found that some 855 contracts to build schools, hospitals, and transport systems were never completed because of high costs, logistical delays, poor performance, and violent conditions. The BBC quoted audit officials as saying the reconstruction of Iraq has cost American taxpayers more than $107 billion. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
A black woman from Virginia whose lawsuit helped end bans on interracial marriage has died. Mildred Loving and her white husband, Richard, changed history in 1967 when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down laws across the country that prohibited interracial marriages. Loving told the Associated Press last year that she didn't set out to change history, but was just a girl who fell in love with a boy. Loving died Friday at her home. She was 68 years old. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abel.
Burma is reeling from the devastating cyclone that hit at speeds up to 150 miles per hour on Saturday. Officials announced the death toll at 4,000, but it's likely as high as 15,000. Thousands more are missing or displaced. UN agencies and the International Committee of the Red Cross are preparing emergency assistance, having received the military-ruled Burmese government's approval. FSRN's Ronald Aung Nang reports.
A Burmese government-controlled television station is announcing that 4,000 people are dead and 3,000 more are missing. The number of casualties continues to rise as authorities make contact with hard-hit islands and villages in the delta, the rice bowl of the nation. The storm hit the Aoury Delta and the Burmese largest city of Rangoon. All airline flights and train services have been cancelled. Electricity, water supplies, and most telephone communications, both mobile networks and phone lines, are down. One storm survivor in Rangoon, Nemu, described the damage.
Rangoon has no telephone communication and no water supply. All the roads are blocked. We are also facing difficulties with transportation. The main problem is we don't have water to use nor drink. And also, because there is no electricity, cars cannot fill their tanks with gas at the pump. Also, public transportation is stopped, and the prices of commodities are increasing.
Prices of basic commodities like rice and eggs have doubled. UN agencies estimate that in hundreds of thousands of people have become homeless in the past 3 days. On Monday morning in neighboring Thailand, UN aid agencies and the Red Cross held a meeting concerning immediate assistance for Burma. The Burmese government has just approved the international aid late on Monday. Now, 3 days after the disaster struck, drinking water is running low. Rangoon resident Dicky Mew says that people are getting desperate.
Groups of people are looking for water on the streets. Currently, the water supply was cut. The electricity was also cut. We cannot pump up the water. There is no water in the main water supply pipes. The government could not pump up the water in the main pipes.
The Burmese military announced on Saturday that 24 million of people are living in areas that are under states of emergency. Some survivors, like Malay in Rangoon, say that they are still waiting to see any signs of a rescue team.
There has no rescue efforts or supplies seen yet. We haven't seen any effective works. All the roads are still blocked by the fallen trees. People in the quarters try to clean up by themselves, making some motorways. The big debris which needs machine powers are still blocking the roads. Many roads are still blocked.
Government officials are not available to give comments at this time. For FSRN, this is Rona Online from Thailand.
Voters in North Carolina and Indiana head to the polls tomorrow. These will be the 47th and 48th highly contested Democratic presidential contests. North Carolina will award 115 delegates. Indiana will award 72. Combined, that's more than Pennsylvania allocated 2 weeks ago. In the final stretch, a gas tax holiday is dominating the debate. Senator Hillary Clinton continues to point to the plight of working-class truckers as reason to support a gas tax holiday, but truckers' organizations oppose the idea, calling it useless. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports. On the campaign trail, Senator Clinton points to truckers' long days on the road bearing the brunt of high gas prices. She says truckers will be among those who will benefit from her proposal, which is to suspend the 18 cents per gallon federal gas tax during the summer months. Clinton says the loss of revenue to federal highways and infrastructure would be paid for by increasing taxes on oil companies. Campaign spokesperson Phil Singer.
The biggest problem that so many drivers are facing today is the fact that that gas is becoming simply unaffordable, not for pleasure, not for cruising up and down the strip, but for the basic necessities of life, driving to work, picking up kids at school, truckers finding it increasingly difficult to get their goods to market in a way that they can make a living.
But truckers oppose the idea. The American Truckers Association, which represents trucking companies, which employs many of the 100,000 people in the trucking industry in North Carolina and Indiana, say they did not ask for the gas tax holiday and are more concerned with the loss of federal highway funds that could result. A separate association, the Owner-Operated Independent Drivers Association, the largest association for independent truckers in the U.S., including 10,000 drivers in North Carolina and Indiana, they say it does not get to the root of the problem. Spokesperson Norita Taylor.
We just don't think that they would have enough of an impact. Because, for one thing, cutting taxes are not that different than they were 10 years ago, so it's not that much.
The Independent Truckers Association supports a plan currently being floated in the Senate. Neither association has endorsed a candidate. Senator Barack Obama opposes the idea and has jumped on widespread expert opposition. He calls it political pandering. Here he is campaigning in Indiana.
I mean, this isn't the first time this gas tax holiday's come up. It comes up every 2 years right before election time, right before the summer, because somebody somewhere thinks this will be good politics.
Most economists and environmental groups agree. Economists say there's no proof the tax relief would be passed on to consumers. Environmentalists say the holiday could encourage more driving, contributing to global warming. But the debate over the gas tax holiday has caught on and escalated. In an attempt to not only appeal to white working class voters, but also to marginalize Senator Obama with those voting blocs, Senator Clinton is pointing to Obama's opposition to the holiday as elitist and out of touch. Clinton released a last-minute advertisement discussing the issue in North Carolina and Indiana.
What's happened to Barack Obama?
Right now we're living paycheck to paycheck.
He's attacking Hillary's plan to give you a break on gas prices because he doesn't have one.
Price of gas going up.
It's hard to fill up the tank.
Hillary wants the oil companies to pay for the gas tax this summer, so you don't have to.
Meanwhile, Obama says Clinton will make any short-sighted promise to attract votes. An environmental group, Friends of the Earth, which endorsed Obama over the weekend, released an ad Monday as well.
Hillary Clinton, pandering for votes, then not telling the truth. Clinton siding with John McCain on a gas tax plan that will do nothing to lower the cost of gas.
Another issue that has garnered some attention on the campaign trail is Iran. Senator Obama points to a comment made by Clinton at a debate in Pennsylvania where she says she will, quote, obliterate Iran if Iran obtained and used nuclear weapons against Israel. Obama compares that statement to something President Bush would say. Clinton defended her remarks on CNN this morning. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Voters in Bolivia's richest province, Santa Cruz, voted overwhelmingly for increased autonomy. President Evo Morales calls the process illegal and unconstitutional, even as three more provinces prepare for similar referendums next month. FSRN's Dileta Varlesi reports from Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz, the richest region in the country, approved a referendum yesterday calling for autonomy from the national government of Evo Morales.
Autonomia! 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 Autonomia!
Since 2005, when Evo Morales became Bolivia's first indigenous president, he has pushed for the redistribution of land as well as oil and gas revenues. Ruben Costas is the governor of Santa Cruz region and an opponent of Morales' administration. Costas is typical of politicians in Santa Cruz. He is descended from Spanish colonists, part of the conservative Podemos party, and is a land-owning cattle rancher. He says,
"We're autonomous. We want to be the example of a new concept of state, based on autonomous regions, and we have to push forward for the other 8 regions too. So we all say yes to a federal Bolivia. Long life to Bolivia."
Viva Bolivia!
President Morales has declared the autonomy resolution as unconstitutional. In La Paz and Cochabamba, almost a million of indigenous people rallied to support the Morales government. Maria Luceo, protesting outside a polling station, says the autonomy resolution would entrench inequalities in Bolivia.
"I just want to be equal to them, and I don't want to be forced to beg them for money."
In clashes with police yesterday, at least one person has been killed and 20 people have been seriously injured. Morales supporters say that the richest people in the country only began to call for autonomy after the indigenous movement gained power in the government. The Santa Cruz region boasts the second largest reserve of natural gas in South America and the most fertile flatlands in the nation. What autonomy would mean, according with the new Santa Cruz statute, is that 80% of the wealth produced in Santa Cruz would stay in the region and only 20% would go to the central government. Decisions about land distribution would be decided by the regional government. President Morales affirmed that he is not hostile to autonomy, but the process has to respect the authority of the central government over regional interests. 3 other eastern regions in Bolivia will hold similar autonomy votes next month. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Diletta Varlese in Santa Cruz, Bolivia.
The so-called food versus fuel debate continues at home and around the world. More and more land that was once used to grow food is now being used to grow crops intended for ethanol production. As the demand for biofuels increases, so does the price of corn and other crops used to create energy. The rising cost of energy also makes the transport of food more expensive, yet another contributing factor to the world food crisis. The situation is particularly critical for countries that import basic cereals like wheat. FSRN's Manuel Rueda has this report from Colombia.
It's Saturday morning at Panaderia Verona, a small bakery in Bogotá. The staff is making croissants, butter rolls, and baguettes. The bakery also sells breakfast dishes that include hot chocolate, tamales, and fried eggs. But there aren't too many orders. Bread rolls that used to cost 200 pesos last year now cost 300 or 400. Owner Marta Sanchez says that sales are down by 30%.
"My clients used to ask for 2 or 3 rolls of bread, but today they can only order 1 roll. A client will sit down and ask for a coffee and 1 roll. That's it."
Colombia imports around 90% of its wheat, mostly from Canada and the U.S. It used to be cheaper to import wheat than to produce it locally, but the price of imports is now skyrocketing. Economist Aurelio Suarez says that a ton of wheat now costs twice as much as it did last year.
"There are several reasons for these price rises, including the use of some crops for biofuels, the weakening of supplies due to climate change, and the rising demand in some countries that are now consuming more food than they did before."
Local production could bring wheat prices down, helping to decrease the costs of making bread. But Suarez says that Colombian farmers lack the capacity to respond. Gabriel Suarez owns 5 acres in Boyacá province, just 2 hours from Bogotá. He planted a small wheat field a few weeks ago, but almost half of his land is unused.
"We need money for tractors. And if we find we need to buy fertilizer, you have to pay $70,000 for a sack of that, which is outrageous. And the sack of wheat only sells for $30,000. We can't work this way."
Suarez says he can no longer rely on agriculture to feed his family, so he spends most of the day driving a taxi in Tunja, the capital of Boyacá province. This region produced plenty of wheat in the 60s and 70s, but the crop fell drastically in the 90s, as the Colombian government opened the door to U.S. imports. Support schemes for local farmers were dropped, and many eventually went out of business, unable to compete with subsidized American wheat. Álvaro Contreras directs the local chapter of FENALCE, the National Federation of Cereal Growers.
In Colombia today, the flour industry needs almost 320 tons of soft wheat per year, and we are barely making 50,000. Look at all the space we have.
FENALCE is encouraging farmers to recover some of their wheat. They help farmers to find buyers, and they're also replicating new seeds that will produce better yields. But Contreras says that more government action is needed in areas like credits and technology. Growing wheat is still a risky proposition for farmers like Gabriel Suarez, he says. His children and those of thousands of other farmers have already abandoned the fields in order to pursue a job in the cities. Manuel Rueda, FSRN, Bogotá.
The Environmental Protection Agency's Midwest Regional Director claims that she was pushed out because she fought for stringent pollution controls. Mary Gady was wrangling to get Michigan's Dow Chemical to stop dumping dioxin in local waterways. FSRN correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
Mary Gady became the Midwest Regional Director for the EPA in 2006. She had voted for George W. Bush twice and was known as a professional that commanded respect from the environmental community. But last week, she was told to resign from the EPA by June 1st, or else be fired. She says it's the backlash following a heated fight she had with Dow Chemical. That's what she told the Chicago Tribune last week. Gady used stricter standards on Dow to get it to clean up its Midland, Michigan plant. The plant has the highest level of the cancer-causing toxin, dioxin, found in the world. Gady says she was fired after Dow contested her decision at the EPA's Washington office. She couldn't be reached for comment. An EPA spokesman would only confirm that Gady has resigned. The EPA says that Dow has been compliant with cleaning up its Superfund sites. John Musser, Dow Chemical's spokesman, denies any wrongdoing.
And I'll tell you flatly that we never asked for or implied that Mrs. Gady should be relieved of her duties.
But many environmentalists disagree. Rena Stintzer is a professor of environmental law at the Maryland School of Law. She says the agency has lost its credibility in recent years.
The agency is terribly weakened, the Environmental Protection Agency. It has lost a lot of its finest professionals. It is terribly short of funds. It can barely manage the mandates it has.
On Wednesday morning, California Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer will hold hearings on the regulatory abuses at the EPA. Gady's resignation will take effect on June 1st. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Recent immigration sweeps carried out in Maricopa County, Arizona, led residents of the town of Guadalupe to meet yesterday to discuss their options for terminating their public safety contract with the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff's deputies saturated the town in a two-day operation last month to question residents about their immigration status. Many residents of the heavily Latino and Yaqui Indian town complained of racial profiling and unlawful detentions. The Maricopa County Sheriff has gained national attention for creating a model for local enforcement of federal immigration laws, but some say that he's gone too far. A coalition of local, state, and national groups has launched a 130-mile walk through the Arizona desert to call national attention to what they say is a pattern of racial profiling, hate crimes, and violations of the Constitution in Maricopa County. FSRN's Shannon Young reports.
In Maricopa County, people are speaking out all the way to the mayor of Phoenix, the mayor of Mesa, the mayor of Guadalupe, which is south. They're all very angry, but the sheriff is doing what he wants because he is not being put into check by the federal government.
Texas border resident Jay Johnson Castro is one of the organizers of the 10-day trek from Tucson to Phoenix called the Citizens Walk for Human Dignity.
What we hope to accomplish is not pick on the poor sheriff. We want to pick on the mentality of how do we as a country deal with hate crimes and racial profiling in racist supremacy.
Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio has made a name for himself nationally with measures such as incarcerating prisoners in tent cities in the Arizona desert, cutting back on inmate meals, and bringing back chain gangs, even for female and juvenile offenders. Sheriff Arpaio has also deputized armed private citizens to enforce immigration laws. These deputies have carried out operations in heavily Latino areas of Maricopa County under the banner of crime suppression. Latino and Native American residents have complained that deputies have stopped them on flimsy pretexts in order to have them prove their citizenship or legal residency. The town of Guadalupe is considering the cancellation of its $1.2 million a year public security contract with the sheriff's office. The mayor of Phoenix has sent a letter to Attorney General Michael Mukasey to request that the Department of Justice investigate alleged civil rights abuses.
Right now we're in a situation where there's little relief in an onslaught of attacks on the immigrant community.
Maria Jimenez is the Special Projects Coordinator at the Central American Resource Center in Houston, Texas.
We have the growth of a strong anti-immigrant movement spearheaded by many right-wing groups, which then have led to the institution of other type of laws, local, state, and national, that are stripping the immigrant population of fundamental rights, but particularly the part of the immigrant population that does not have any papers.
Anti-immigrant vigilante groups have been active for years in California and Arizona, but have only recently begun to appear in the Texas-Mexico border region. Father Roy Snipes is the parish priest at Our Lady of Guadalupe in the border town of Mission, Texas, where the vigilante group, the Minutemen, recently held a retreat.
I don't know where they're from. Let's just say, where do you reckon they're from? Oklahoma City. Imagine if I just would go up there to Oklahoma City and say, well, I'm going to come up here with a bunch of my friends from South Texas, and we're going to try to enforce the laws on income tax evasion up here, or maybe the laws on adultery. They'd say, it's none of your damn business. We have people who already do that. Well, that's what we'd say, too. You guys don't know anything about enforcing the law down here. We have Border Patrol agents who are trained for that, and we're not asking for your help. In fact, what we would ask, if we could look at them eyeball to eyeball, is, for God's sake, please get out of our little town.
Texas border resident Jay Johnson Castro says that the rise of anti-immigrant vigilantism, combined with the law enforcement policies in Maricopa County, is not just a regional issue, but something that requires national attention. He makes the comparison with how law enforcement was able to operate in Selma, Alabama in the 1960s.
40 years later, and this guy's getting away with it. But he is popular within his community, which says that there is a community there, just as there was in Selma, that endorsed hate crimes. So this ends up being an American situation. This is a national issue. Do we want this kind of mindset to actually be in power?
The Tucson to Phoenix march is currently in its fourth day and is scheduled to arrive in Phoenix on May 11th. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can find us online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Jess Burns and Puck Lowe, sitting in for Monica Lopez. Today's headlines editor is Nell Abram, sitting in for Shannon Young. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi, Eric Klein, and Oscar Hernandez. From KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Bogado.